Well, hello, everybody. Welcome. I thank you very much for coming to be with us in this time, in this venue. I'm very happy to see everybody, or at least to see your names on the screen here. I often make fun of the news commentators when they say, "We're so happy to see you," which, of course, they can't see us at all, and nor can I see you, but I know you're here. And I'm happy that you're here. I often speak about the fact that what I have to say is really very little, not very much at all. And I'm reminded often in my own mind of Nisargadatta's teacher, the story of Nisargadatta's teacher, and how Nisargadatta found him, and the guy said to him something to the effect of, "Just stay with the feeling I am. Just stay with that, and it'll take you home." And then promptly dropped dead without providing Nisargadatta with any follow-up instruction or correction or discussion or anything else. And really, I don't have much more to say than that. I don't say it quite as poetically, but I have not much more to say than that. Pretty much I have to say to anyone in this realm is, look at yourself. Just that. Look at yourself. As often as it occurs to you to do so, as often as you can, look at yourself. Now, so far I haven't dropped dead on you and left you hanging, wondering what in the world can I possibly be talking about with this look at yourself business, but I tell you that really that's all there is to what I have to offer. Everything that follows that is discussion and elaboration and explanation and perhaps some guidance and encouragement and reassurance. The truth is that all that I, if you take just this one thing that I say and try with all your heart to see what it is that I'm talking about, it's enough. Look at yourself as often as you can, because it is the seeing that does all the work. All of the activities of the mind in trying to understand how to do it, what to do, where to go, what it feels like, what it should be, what you should be, what it's going to mean to your life, what it does to your body and so forth. All of these things are after the fact. Just look at yourself. The seeing does the work. None of the commentary or the confusion or the efforts to understand do any work at all, except to the extent that they provide some, comfort to the mind flailing about, seemingly trying to, I don't know what it's trying to do. Go crazy, I guess. But it's also true that human beings, this business of self-inquiry and this business of the role of false belief about what we are in the misery and suffering of humanity is very old, and people have been talking about it for a long time. People have developed methods and practices and understandings and techniques and so forth, all in an attempt to erase this misidentification, this misunderstanding about what we are, that all agree gives rise to the horror show that is the human species. And what we do is that, and I am also certain, let me say this, I'm certain that everybody for the entire history of humanity, including now, in this time, in this place, in this age, everybody who comes forward seeking to convey some taste of truth to us. Everybody who comes forward trying to bring to us the possibility of an end to suffering in our lifetimes, all of us, myself included, are sincere. And some of us are better at it, and some of us are not so good at it, but all of us have the same thing we're trying to do. But the only thing that counts is this invitation and this suggestion and this insight that if you will see yourself directly, everything else will be taken care of. All the confusion, all the relationship with pain, all of that will be taken care of. And we, on the other hand, we, knowing ourselves to be lost in a swamp of misery and suffering and ignorance, we are anxious to find someone in authority, someone with the authority to tell us what we are, to tell us what we should do, what we should be, how we should go about doing it. Not just tell us to look at ourselves or to stay with the feeling I am, because these things are, these admonitions, these suggestions are fraught with contradiction and complication and so forth. But to tell us how to do it, how to find ourselves, what we feel like, where we're to look, what does it mean when our mind goes crazy? How can we stop our mind from being as ignorant and stupid as it is? All of that. We're looking for someone with the authority to be able to lead us away from the bondage of Egypt into the promised land. We're looking for somebody with the authority to explain to us the craziness of our minds and to help us calm it down. We're looking for somebody with the authority to lead us home so that we're finished with our misery, so that we're finished with our efforts to get home. And that's really that's why we come to these meetings and with such the attitude of supplicants. We not everybody, I don't think everybody's like this, but from my own experience with my own relationship with spiritual teachings and spiritual teachers, I know that what we want is to be given something, to be that we know that we are lacking. We know that we are to give us what we need, for God's sake. Not to tell us what to do so much as to give us what we need. But when we've seen, or at least we have accepted, or we have seen the sensibility and the common sense of the insight that we are not what we think we are, and that everything else that we do is beside the point, and so long as we don't have a clue what we are, or we are deluded about what we are, I don't remember where I was going with that sentence, but it's okay. The point is this. Once we know that what we're after is the truth of what we are, who in the world has greater authority in this question, in this matter, than you? How is it possible that anyone, anywhere to be found, whether in the distant past or sitting in a chair beaming waves of peace and calm and bliss and so forth, who can possibly have the authority to speak to you about what you are? to tell you what you are, to tell you where you can find yourself, to tell you how to go about doing it. Who can do that? Who? You. That's who. Only you. Once the excitement and the energy of the possibility of finally, once and for all, being finished with the false, seeing the light of truth wipe out the false, once that energy and that desire and that intention is present, I guarantee you that no matter how well or poorly you conduct the investigation, no matter how childish or adult you are in your relationship with the consequences of the investigation, I guarantee you that once you really want to know the truth, you'll find it. Once you really want to know, once you see that what you've always really wanted is to know the truth of what you are and to be finished with all of the nonsense about it, you'll know where to look. You'll know. Still, I have to say that that there is some usefulness in spiritual teachings to people like me coming and speaking to people like you about my experience and about you, your experience. There is some usefulness to it, so long as we don't drop dead on you and leave you on your own. The usefulness comes from the fact that I have known the same confusion, the same conflict, the same paradoxical madness as you do. I have known that. I've been there. I have, in fact, when I actually finally really seriously embarked on trying to enact Ramana's insight in my own life, when I actually seriously embarked on that, I was locked away from any help in that effort. I had no availability of anyone that I could speak to or ask for help in the craziness that ensued as a result of actually taking on this investigation. So that's my usefulness to you. It's not that I have something to give you, something to bestow upon you, some state or transcendent something that I can give you and make you what you should be and so forth, but because I have been way, way dumber than any of you could possibly imagine in enacting this insight of Ramana's. This insight of the power of self-seeing, the absolute, unbelievable, incredible power of self-seeing to wipe out all the false, to eradicate it, to destroy it. Not to eradicate the mind, not to eradicate thought, not to eradicate good impulses to eradicate bad impulses or enhance good impulses. The power in self-seeing to do away with all belief about what we are. And in the absence of all belief about what we are, to realize the actuality of being, of existence, the actuality of my nature, the actuality of me. Now, since I have so little to say, since I don't have an elaborated theory of everything to bestow upon you, all I can do is come to you and say, look at yourself, and come to you and say, the seeing does all the work, and come to you and say, There's no way in the world I can tell you how to do this, but if you will try, you will learn for yourself. And the only other thing that I can do, and this to me, I think is the crux of the usefulness of meeting together like this, the real heart of it, of meeting together like this, is I can have conversations with you. I can hear directly from you and respond directly to you about the issues and problems that arise within you in the practice of this magnificent method. It's really a way of life. And that can help all, because all of us are in the same boat, because all of us have the same results from this method, all of us. And although some may have result specific quality of the arising of experience in the practice of this method may differ from person to person, all recognize that there are very few things that happen in the mind and in the life as a result of the inquiry. And you can see that by hearing what other people have to say and how I respond to them. You can see that for yourself and perhaps not be quite so floored and taken aback when different, predictable, expected phenomena arise in the practice of the inquiry. I receive a lot of email, and I have a very difficult time responding to it because it's just a lot of it. And there's a lot of other work that takes up my time aside from my relationship with you, which my relationship with you, of course, is what I prefer to do. But, well, so far, a lot of my time is taken from that relationship to support the foundation of that, practical measures whereby that relationship can grow and be fed and so forth, the financial and physical and all of that stuff. But I do receive an awful lot of email, and since doing this these online meetings and inviting people to write to me at the online address at the website, I've been receiving more emails there too. So what I'm going to do more of, and I think I'm going to start here today, is since it is my view that the usefulness of satsang, the usefulness of meeting together here, is not so that you can be kissed by me with some insight or some breakthrough or some enlightenment experience, but rather it comes almost entirely from the interaction between us, the conversation between us. And it's my sense and it's my view that these spiritual meetings are much more useful in conversation than they are in the sermons that I preach before the conversations begin. I think I'm going to start using the sermon time a little more to have more conversation by reading to you a few emails that I receive and responding to them here in this meeting, because, and some of them you will recognize, they may come from you, they may not, you may not know, but I do this because the conversation is everything. Actually, what everything is you, and the only thing that needs to be done ever to be finished with the undercurrent of fearfulness and anxiety that so characterizes human existence is to look at yourself. But the conversation can help that. So, I'm going to start reading a couple emails. Dear John, I've been meditating for 2 years with different kinds of Osho meditations intensively, and it made a big change in my life and personality, including a constant feeling of bliss, special higher consciousness states, and the experience that the mind doesn't control me, which is extremely valuable experience, the experience that the mind doesn't control you. The rest of them are, you know, they come and go. When I first heard about non-dualism ideas, especially the urge to find the me, I felt it goes straight to the root of the problem, and I decided to stop meditating totally and concentrate only on investigating who I am and witnessing my mind. I've been doing it in the last year and a half. Since starting the investigation, I have had several glimpses as to what is the real me and what is false, but it is far from stabilizing. I'm still totally identified with my thoughts, body feelings, etc. My problem is that my mind is frustrated and noisy. I lost all bliss. The mind is managing the investigation, controlling me, so there is no space to the other thing to come. I'm so obsessed with thinking, so perfectionist in my spiritual path. I don't have much emotions inside, and far from the stereotype of the egoless, kind, and quiet spiritual seeker. My question is, can a person find their true self when their mind is so busy and their personality is so far from being clean? Or should I take some time first for meditation in order to be mentally quiet, acting from my heart instead of from my brain? The purpose of the inquiry, the purpose of this effort to see oneself its purpose is not to teach you how to stop misidentifying with the body or the mind. It's not the purpose of it. It is natural for us to assume that if I am to do something worthwhile for myself, that I need to find the way to do it, and how to, like, finding something worthwhile for myself being the identifying correctly with what I am rather than misidentifying with what I am not, and so forth. It's natural for us to think that when I speak about the fact that the problem is a false belief about what we are, that we need to figure out what we can do with our mind and our thoughts and our internal activities to rid myself of to stop myself from identifying with the wrong thing and turn myself to identification with the right thing. But this all makes sense only if what I am is this mind and this life that occupies itself with all of the nonsense that it occupies itself with. I mean, surely it is true that if all that I am is my life, if all that I am is this mind, this history, this conglomeration of phenomenal experience and hope and judgment and expectation and so forth, that that's all I am, then it's extremely important that what I do bring about a change in that phenomenon of me, that it bring about a change in the way I see things, the way I relate to things, and the way I think about things, and the way I eliminate my confusion and my excitation and my all that stuff. If it's true that this life is all that I am, then certainly it's true that the most important thing that's happening are the things that are happening in this mind, in this life. The confusion and so forth is far more important than anything else, and if it continues, then the problem continues. But I tell you that you are not this life alone. You are not. This life, its substance, its ground, its nature, is you. But you are not it. And the although it can be useful, you know, there are some meditation practices that can be useful, like mindfulness meditation, which is a very simple Buddhist-based meditation that they can be helpful. The mind itself is, after all, the only thing that's conducting the investigation. It's not controlling you, but it certainly is controlling the investigation. It's the only thing that's doing it. So mindfulness meditations that give the mind a little more skillfulness at being able to control its wild swings from one thing to the other, that can be helpful, but even that's not necessary. None of it's necessary. Look and see. Look at yourself just for a second and see whether any of this noisiness and craziness and madness of the mind touches you at all. Of course it doesn't. You're the same as always. You bear no scars from the noise of the mind. And I tell you that if you will, just without regard to your judgment about how inept your mind is at doing this, if you will just look at yourself as often as you can, if you will just get this seeing of yourself, this light that you are, as often as you can, that is what does the work. That's all that's needed. There's no need to do anything about the mind. There's no need to make it quiet. There's no need to stop it from being obsessive. There's no need to stop it from being perfectionist. There's no need to keep it being perfectionist and obsessive. All that's needed is to look at yourself. That's all. As often as you can. The goal is not to learn how to become unidentified with thought. The goal is to destroy the belief that you are thought alone at its source. And the light does that. The light of seeing yourself. I hope that's helpful. Here's another one. Another conversation. Dear John, I am so grateful for you and your ability to point to the truth. I have a question. I constantly return to a very deep sense of peace. It is there hiding under all my actions in this life. My life and circumstances seem to take my attention from it, but when I stop and see, there it is. Is this what you are pointing to? Is this me? It feels as if this peace comes and goes, and as such would not be me, but something is telling me that it never goes. I just lose sight of it, ignore it, in order to take part in this world dream fantasy. Well, I think you must know that it's you, otherwise you wouldn't tell me that it feels as if this peace that seems to come and go is actually never going. You trust yourself, really, you know. The peace that you are is not an experience. This is the reason it's impossible for anybody to tell you or me or anybody else exactly what it feels like to look at yourself. Only you can see that. The moment that I start speaking, I am getting further and further away from it. With every word I utter, I am further away from it. I promise you this, you are not hiding from yourself. That's not happening. And I promise you this, that if you will continue to return to whatever it is that you are describing as a very deep sense of peace, if you will continue to return to that, and if it continues to tell you that this is what you really are, then I tell you that that's all that's needed. And the fact is that the fact that you are not experiencing it, it's the experience of it that comes and goes, not the reality of it. Consider this. The whole, wherever you're sitting now, wherever you're sitting and listening to this, taking part in this and so forth, everything that you see and everything that you think and every thought that comes and every movement you make with your hand and your computer and the monitor you may be looking at, all these things, all of them, every bit of them, are occupying space. Even the distance between you and the wall, is that distance is occupying space. Now, you can't see that space. There's no way you can see it with your eyes or touch it with your hands, because your hands themselves are occupying that space. The monitor is occupying that space. Thought occupies that space. Your body occupies that space. That space never changes. It's never gone. It's always the same. Always. And you almost never are aware of it. You are aware of distance. You're aware of objects and so forth. But if you take just a second to sit, close your eyes or leave your eyes, it doesn't matter. Just sit and see if you cannot get the taste of spaciousness. Now, you will. In fact, there's an elaborate Buddhist meditation on space that has the same purpose. You will be able to get a taste of spaciousness. And then see if it's not true that in the next moment when you're thinking about it and trying to describe it or understand it or explain it and so forth, you no longer see it. Does that mean the space has come and gone? Or only your attention has come and gone? You look at reality and you know that it's always there. Just as you say in your email, you lose sight of it, but you know it never goes. And it's that knowing that tells you that you're in the right spot. Nothing else can tell you that. None of the spiritual works, none of the explanations, none of the teachings, none of the practices, none of that can tell you that, except this silent knowing. Silent knowing that it's there, whether you are conscious of it or not conscious of it. So, see this. The seeing is everything. All the rest is beside the point. Not bad, not good, not bad, just beside the point. Okay? Okay, here's another one. Dear John, thank you for dedicating your life to this that can't be spoken. John, and let me say I am proof positive that it can't be spoken, or not by me anyway. John, I find that I am at the end of my rope. I've tried everything over the past 6 years to finally be done with suffering and live this awareness that we naturally are. I am always aware of this silence, but the me is also very much here. I see the silence and gaze into it, but there has been a growing terror and panic that has come to the surface, and for the past 2 years I've been plagued by it. My heart speeds up, my arms tingle, and I'm afraid I'm going to hurt my body through experiencing all this stress. I try to look into and just experience the fear and maybe find a bit of short-lived relief. I look at myself as you suggest, but the fear continues. This has been going on for a long time, and I wonder how much longer my body will hang in there. Another teacher has told me that there's nothing that can be done at this stage in the game. When the identification with the me is ready to dissolve, it will do it on its own time. It's so hard for me to know what's needed, and doubt arises when I see myself suffering more and more. You've said over and over again simply to look at myself. It feels so easy at times, but I've been finding lately that my life has been getting smaller and smaller as this terror arises almost everywhere. I refuse to let this stop me from living my life fully. Will this pass on its own, John? Well, yes, actually it will pass on its own, and actually it is the case that there's nothing you can do. But there's never been anything you could do about any of it anyway. Never. The effort, the miserable effort to try to do something about the arising and falling of phenomenal experience is the heart and soul of the suffering of humanity. Then never have you been able to do anything about it. What it is that you, the person, is doing about it, of course, is calling it fear, calling it confusion, calling it, identifying it, seeing what it is, what you're trying to figure out, what you can do about it, and so forth. And there's nothing you can do about it. You could perhaps sit and be quiet, you know, and as you said here, the technique of just receiving it and experiencing it and doing nothing about it, that can be helpful at times, but not always. And it depends on, God knows what it depends on. It depends on whether Mercury's in retrograde, maybe, whether these things work or not. I mean that as a joke, by the way. But I tell you this from my heart. How can I say this? Of course I know exactly what you're speaking of. I know the terror. I know the horror. I know I know all of that. In the midst of the terror, when the fearfulness is the greatest, when it seems that the fearfulness prevents you from looking at yourself, in the midst of all of it, see if you cannot have the conscious awareness of the space in which it's taking place. See if you cannot have the conscious awareness of the subject of this terror, the phenomenon that is afflicted by this terror. In the midst of the terror and the agitation and all of the confusion, just take 1 second to look and see who sees this. Just that. The truth is that the terror and the confusion and the agitation can be your ally if only you will, for just 1 second, ignore the idea that it must be gotten rid of. Just for 1 second and look at yourself. The object, the subject, the one who feels it. This practice, this technique, this way of life is, there's no way to predict from one person to the next what the course of events will be once the inquiry is begun. For me, the course of events was miserable, horrible, terrifying, frustrating. Stupefying, even, for a very long time. For others, the course of events is, oh, I see. Well, thank you very much, sir. No one can tell from one individual to the other what the course of events is that will be triggered by this inquiry. Just look at yourself. Just see. Just look at yourself. These things are not hurting you. The good times are not helping you. Only the seeing does the work. The terror cannot harm you. It is experience only. It is internal, emotional, thought experience only. It cannot harm you. Look at yourself. See what you are. What the terror is beside the point. What its course is beside the point. See what you are. See what your course is. See, do you come and go? And the seeing that results from that, and it's one of the hard things about all this, is that it seems like I'm saying that everything will be cleared up in the mind, but that's not what I'm saying. The seeing itself, the allowance of the light of reality to shine into this individual mind, it's that that does the work. And it doesn't necessarily translate into any recognizable consequence in the mind. Look at yourself. It's all there is to do. And you're doing it well. Actually, your terror is kind of proof of that. You know, there are a lot of stories told about this existential terror that attends spiritual practice and so forth. And sometimes I feel tempted to turn to that method of utterance in order to, I don't know, make people feel better or something. But that's all made up. All the business about ego being terrified and trying to protect itself and all that stuff, that's just all a story. It's all interpretation. There is this experience that arises in some, in tandem with the inquiry. That's all. You are not touched by it. You are unhurt by it. You are unscarred by it. Keep up the looking. Okay, here's a short one. Two questions. How does the work of many current Advaita teachers fit into your teaching? For example, most of the teachers say to bring presence or tenderness or love to one's feelings of sadness, fear, etc. Where does that fit into your teaching? Well, I don't think it fits into my teaching at all, to tell you the truth. I don't know anything about the work of many current Advaita teachers. I barely have enough time to keep up with the work of this pseudo-Advaita teacher. I know about the teachings about bringing presence and love to feelings of sadness and fear, etc. And I think that that's quite all right. I think it might very well bring about some amelioration of the internal feeling of hurtfulness and so forth, but it won't last. It'll shift to some other set of circumstances. But I think these ideas of bringing presence and tenderness and love to sadness and fear are quite okay. They're, for the short run, it's like taking an aspirin for a headache, and it's quite okay. I recommend aspirin for headache, in fact. But it really doesn't have anything to do with what I'm offering. You know, there are others who are skilled at these practices and these techniques. And I don't know who they are, but I know there are some. But it's just not, I don't know anything about it. I don't know what to say about it, except that if you will look at yourself as often as it's possible to do so, the sense that the tenderness, love, the presence and tenderness and love are good, and the sense that the feelings of sadness and fear need to be expunged, that will go away. Look at yourself. see yourself always. See yourself when the experience is tenderness, love, and presence. See yourself when the experience is sadness, fear, and horror. See yourself always. And the seeing will take care of it all in ways that can't be imagined. Take care of it all. And the second question in this email was also, when you say to look for the self, are you supposed to feel it or sense it as the thing that is watching? In Ojai, you said it was nothing you could find. I'm a little confused. Am I supposed to find it? Or is the point that you can't find it, that is? Well, it's not lost, first of all. So, really, the point is not to find it. The point is to see it. You are it, by which I mean you, are ever present. You're never absent. You're never gone missing. You're always here. Whether you're watching or not depends on circumstances, I guess. But you're always here. You're always present. You're always the same. You're always unscarred. Always. You are the same. You are not lost. There is not a nanosecond in time that you are not here, and there is not a nanosecond in time that you are not seeing yourself. Only thing is that you don't recognize what it is to be seeing yourself as seeing yourself. So we look to other things, and we look for other explanations and other assurances and all of that. But you're not absent. You don't need to be found. And all that's needed is to just look. If you take it upon yourself as your purpose, not like a purpose that you should keep in mind every minute of the day and let you backslide or something, but in the moments that you are enacting this insight about reality and false belief that is self-inquiry, in the time that you are doing that, your purpose must be just to see yourself. Just that. Nothing else. No consequences. No results from it. No knowing what it feels like. Just to see yourself. And if you have that as your purpose in this moment, as you sit here listening to me, if you have that as your purpose, you will see yourself. Because you're always seeing yourself, don't you see? Again, it's kind of like space. There's never, ever a moment in time when you're not aware of space, of spaciousness. Never. And yet, it takes a special intention, actually, to have the taste of spaciousness, the direct, unmediated experience of spaciousness. That's very similar. So I'm afraid I can't be any help to you in telling you what it feels like, but I can tell you that you already feel it, you already sense it, already, always already. And you're not absent, you're not missing, you don't need to be found. I'm going to do one more, and we'll continue sharing these conversations together like this over time, as time goes on. I'm going to read one more, and then perhaps we can have our own conversation in real time here. Hi, John. I am listening to the Worldwide Satsang, but about to sign off because it's difficult to hear over the storm. I heard, though, you speak of intention. Which, of course, is, I just spoke of that again. That I heard, though, you speak of intention, that this is what really matters in self-inquiry. I don't think I, in recent years, have a clear intention to discover truth directly. I used to, but more recently I feel too worried about everyday problems. Discovering truth feels like saying goodbye to life as I know it, and I don't feel ready to do that. Even with all of the difficulties, problems, and things that I would like to be done with. And I don't feel like I can leave that behind. Also, the good things too, of course. I don't want to say goodbye to those either. So what do I do with this? Just say I'm not ready yet? I don't want to live my whole life without discovering the truth? That seems like a waste of time. But right now, I just don't feel ready. Maybe in a few years. But then I don't know if I'll live that long. Is self-inquiry without solid intention still beneficial? Is there a way to get back to having that intention? I believe I had it years ago, but then when no awakening happened, I started to feel cynical and also more fearful, like I put all my energy into the investigation for a while and then burned out, and now can't seem to really get back. I still do self-inquiry, but now it's with the secret hope that nothing too scary happens, no changes or shocks that are more than what I think I can handle. Anyhow, I don't know if any of that makes sense, but please let me know if you have any comments or suggestions. Yeah, well, all of that makes sense, actually. It's very familiar to me. And I know that I've spoken about intention, and this is an example of difficulty when we get to speaking about these things. The intention I speak of is not the intention to discover truth directly. This is a really important distinction to see. Sometimes distinctions are important. The intention I speak of is not the intention to discover truth directly or to, you know, to finally, I'm after the truth and nothing else. The truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. It's not like that. The intention I speak of is the intention that arises when the inclination to look at yourself arises. It is part and parcel of that inclination to look at yourself. The inclination to engage in self-inquiry. It is, in fact, indistinguishable from the inclination to look at yourself, to engage in self-inquiry. And what I mean by it is this. As I am so boring with saying again and again, you are always here. You are never not seeing yourself. Never. There is never a moment we are not aware of reality. Never. It just simply isn't the case. And in time you'll see exactly what I'm talking about, which isn't at all what the words sound like. You're never, ever not seeing yourself. Never. You are never unaware of the truth. Never. The intention is not to discover the truth. The intention is the intention simply to receive the experience of being directly without mediation, the experience of existence, the experience of the spaciousness of the container of all things whatsoever, directly, unmediated, without understanding or explanation. That's the intention I speak of. And that intention, like the inclination to inquire, comes and goes. And it comes and goes on its own. And there's absolutely nothing you can do about that. In the very beginning, the energetic need to see yourself can be very important. But only once. Only once. Once that is served one time, from then on in, the inclination to look at yourself arises on its own and brings with it the intention. So it's not like you need to change your whole way of living and your whole way of looking at things. And you have to dedicate yourself to the truth of being. All you ever have to do is look at yourself. Just look at yourself directly. And the urge and the inclination to do so arises spontaneously on its own. And there's nothing for you to do except to do it. Where am I? What am I? What is this? I know I'm here. I know it. What is that? What doesn't change? What doesn't move? Just for a second. 10 seconds. The seeing does all the work. The seeing, you see, and I'm trying to be precise here. It's not the looking, it's the seeing. The looking is what brings you in contact with the seeing. So look at yourself. Let the seeing, let the light do the work. The idea that this is another thing, and there's other emails that I would read, but we're running out of time. The other part of your email in which you speak about the fact that you don't feel ready to just say goodbye to life and all of that, this also is something that is a common report from people who begin this investigation, is the sense that, oh my God, I have to give up everything it is to be human. I have to give up my life. I have to, and I'm going to end up not wanting to do anything. I get actually many emails from people who some time into the investigation feel like they are just losing all interest in life. And they are fearful that this will mean that they end up, I don't know, homeless on the street, begging for their food. Or not caring about their food. Your life lives itself, my friends. Your life lives itself. This idea of the fearfulness of becoming one of the lotus eaters, a navel gazer, or things along that line, this is all just story. It comes maybe to everybody who enters into the investigation. It certainly came to me. I remember it very vividly, the feeling that this meant, oh my God, I'm just going to become completely unconcerned about anything. And maybe I'll just rot. But that's just a story. If you are to become completely disengaged from your life, that will happen whether you do the inquiry or do not do the inquiry. If you are to remain engaged with your life, which is the case for, so far as I know, almost everybody, even Ramana, if you are to remain engaged with your life, that will be the case whether you do the inquiry or do not do the inquiry. The inquiry, the reception into this phenomenon of the idea of personal consciousness, the reception into this phenomenon of the light of reality, has truly no effect on the way the life plays out, except to remove from the life the undercurrent of fear and anxiety that causes it constantly to try to fix something, to try to hold something, to try to get rid of something, to try to kill something. Life lives itself. It's not for you to, and the idea that doing the inquiry is going to cause this consequence in your life is just a new version of all the old ideas we have held about how other things are going to cause good or bad consequences in our life as we shift around trying to figure out whether we should do this or should not do the other thing. Has nothing to do with the power, the force of seeing reality. Nothing to do with it at all. It's just a story. Not that stories are bad. Not that there's anything wrong with them. Okay, I have lots of other emails, and they're just going to have to wait. And the thing is that they really don't get stale, because even though it's my experience and understanding from my own history, even though the things that seem the most excruciatingly urgently in need of addressing, even though those things pass and it's hard to remember after a while why you were so caught up with them in the first place, there's always somebody who is in exactly the same spot. So I'm going to continue reading these emails as we go along over time, and now we're going to talk to you directly. We're going to have a conversation directly with you. Please let me know what you think about this business of reading emails and talking about them with you. Please let me know what you think about this business, that my claim, my opinion, my assertion that it is the conversation that's everything in these meetings, and the sermons are very little except entertainment. And, you know, not that there's anything wrong with entertainment. So, who wants to talk to me now?
Now we have Venki calling from New Bern, North Carolina.
Venki?
Hey, John. I come bearing very good news.
Good news is good.
I stumbled across you like some 7-8 months ago. And before that, I'd spent a lot of time and effort reading a lot of this metaphysical things. I don't know why, but I got into it. And then something you said about direct, immediate experience appealed to me. But after that, it was the searching for new answers and new explanations never stopped. But I kept hearing what you had to say, and then something you said really, like, spoke to the core of me, and this happened very recently, and then since that, you know, like, miraculously, the burden has been completely lifted off of my shoulders, John, and I'm really grateful to you for that. I have a name for you. I think you are a spiritual Einstein, but spiritual is a dirty word.
Well, I am so happy to hear that the burden's gone from you, Venki. This is what I live for, really. And I don't know about Einstein, but spiritual's not a dirty word. It just has its really strict limitations. Anything else? Can I help you in any way?
I just want to just tell you very briefly the couple of insights that you gave that really drove the point home. First thing you said was that in one of your podcasts, it suddenly hit me. You said the belief can never be seen. You keep saying unseen belief, but it never really sunk in. And then I was like, wow, all this effort in trying to see the belief is useless. The point is to look at yourself. And then the other insight was in one of your conversations with Richard Miller, you had this other beautiful insight, and it was so obvious, and I, like, can't figure out why I couldn't figure it out. You said, if it is true that you are not your life, then you have never been your life. And I just like, oh my God, that's right. If it's true, then I've never been my life, and then what have I been? And nowadays, if any negative thought or anything comes in, the self-inquiry kind of automatically jumps in and looks at itself. And of course, there are all these freaky experiences, like I was watching TV the other day, and then I see a face of a character, and then I realize, oh my God, that's me. And, you know, everything I look at is me, and I'm not doing anything other than looking at myself. And I don't know if it is sacrilegious to say this, but the teaching itself is me, in a way, John. And the only thing I'm left with is a sense of wonder and the good, bad, silent peace, stillness, and all these words kind of repulse me now, that now I see what exactly you're talking about. So thank you very much, John. But please answer the sacrilegious part, because I have a feeling that the teaching also is me in a way.
The teaching is you, Venki. Pure and clear, the teaching is you. There is nothing that is not you. Nothing. And the teaching shines through you. Thank you so much for this report.
Well, John, I just want to tell everybody that cut through all the BS and go to the core of what John is saying. Just listen to what he keeps saying again and again, and you don't need anything else to look at yourself. And John, keep it up, and I wish you all the best, John. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Venki. And I'm sure we'll talk again. Anybody else?
Yes, the one is going to try again. Let's see.
Hello?
Hello? Hi, Dwani, there you are.
Hello, John, here I am, yes, yes. Very nice hearing you, John. I was not expecting, actually, to be able to talk to you, because I saw a long list of people today, and I feel lucky, actually, I can speak to you. And I have two things, John. A few days ago in a podcast, I heard you saying that when we have a direct experience of what we are, we don't need to stay there. We don't need to hold that experience. And probably you said it 100 times before, but I heard you many times repeating that you keep saying the same things. And I feel it's precious that actually you keep repeating, you keep doing it, because there is a moment that what you say simply strikes and is perfect, and I only heard it in that moment. I don't need to keep the experience, and it was totally precious for me, this aspect of self-inquiry. And the other thing is that I see how I keep swapping between hell and heaven, let's say, because at first there was a strong attraction to self-inquiring. There was a strong intention to look at myself. And then slowly a repulsion came, and with it a feeling of guilt. So I feel trapped between these two aspects, wanting to doing it, and feeling I want to stay away from it.
Well, it's certainly true that I don't remember what I was going to say is true, but it is certainly true that in the mind, and the mind that has enacted and begun with the work of self-inquiry, it is certainly true that there will be mixed feelings. I mean, in some ways, these mixed feelings show up in really dramatic form, such as the horror and the terror and all of that. And in some cases, they don't show up in quite so dramatic a form, but they do show up, as you say. Sometimes you feel drawn toward the inquiry, and sometimes you feel like you really don't want to do that anymore. And that's okay. That really is beside the point, you see, because if it's true that what you are is your life alone and your mind with its opinions and viewpoints and preferences and so forth, if it's true that that's what you are and there's nothing more, the body and all, there's nothing more to you than that, then these things are of great importance, the vacillation between heaven and hell, the inclination to do inquiry, and then the resistance and pulling away from inquiry. If it's true that you're doing all that, then these things are vitally important, and it's really important that we expunge the resistance to inquiry and enhance the welcoming of inquiry. But if that's not true, then none of that has any effect anyway. that all of that then is a mechanical unfolding of this phenomenon that goes by the name of Dwani. And if it's not true that you are this phenomenon, then the vacillation of the mind is of no consequence. Because when you tell me that there are times when you are drawn to the inquiry, and there are times that you are repulsed by the inquiry, well, that's no different than me saying, you don't have to do it all the time, just when it occurs to you to do so. Because it does occur to you to do so from time to time. And that's all that counts. The fact that your mind is slippery, and, you know, that's what minds are. They're slippery, fickle. They can't be relied upon. But the inquiry brings itself to your mind. And it is that appearance of a draw toward it that is what I speak of as the inclination to look at yourself. And that can be, you know, it can take all kinds of forms. If we're really lucky, it takes the form of really no big thing. Like you're washing the dishes and the thought occurs to you, oh, wait a minute, what does it feel like to be me? Or in other cases, it can be grounded in philosophical speculation and practical considerations and all of that stuff. But always, it spontaneously arises, as does the resistance to it spontaneously arise. And that only matters if it's you that is resisting and it's you that is drawn. If that's not true, then that vacillation is of no importance at all. It's irrelevant, beside the point. And the inquiry will reveal the truth once and for all. It won't reveal the truth like you, it won't necessarily reveal the truth in an event like a sudden dawning insight where everything becomes clear. In fact, I would say it very rarely comes in that form. It steals on you like a thief in the night over time. It steals, creeps up on you over time, this eradication of this false belief, this receiving of reality. Just as, you know, Venki was just telling, was talking about the usefulness about the usefulness of saying you don't have to stay there. You don't have to stay there. You are there. You are that. You don't have to stay there. You don't have to leave there. You don't have to do anything. The seeing does it all over time. And the eradication of the belief that causes you to think that it matters that these vacillation occurs in your mind will have already happened before you know it's happened. Do you follow me?
Yes, John. Yes. I see how somehow deep-seated is the idea of perfectionism. It's like self-inquiry is to be perfect, as if I want it and I like it, I always have to want it and I always have to like it, and it is not so, actually.
Right, if you always have to want to, then you're in trouble, because wanting really comes and goes. We want one thing one day, and the next minute we want something else. Just as it occurs to you, as it happens, that this impulse to look at yourself appears, just follow it, and everything else will be taken care of. Do you hear that?
Yes, John. Yes, thank you. Much, much love.
And you, Dwani, and thank you for your magnificent work on Italian translation on something you did with Carla. Where I am always so grateful when people do that, and this possibility is offered, and languages that other people can hear other than English. So thank you for that, too. I'm sure I'll talk to you again soon. Stay well.
It was my joy, Johnny.
Now we have Katie calling from Kitchener, Canada.
Hi, Katie. It's my pleasure to hear you. What can I do for you?
Well, first off, I guess the best way to announce what I feel is a deep privilege to be met here. And I say that to everybody listening because if there's been anything that I've experienced very, very directly from doing your work and the work in the largest sense is just how really deep it is and how empowering it is to just be met at this place and to have it shared by everyone else, so to speak.
Yeah, I'm very happy with that, too.
Should I just move on here? I have just a couple things to say, and really what it has to do with is how much I feel resonance in so many of the words that all your other listeners have shared.
Yes, please. Just start speaking.
Well, it was interesting that you brought up the idea of attention. And what I've noticed in my experience, and really this is a report for everybody, it feels like to the extent that it occurs to me to pay attention, to do the inquiry, that sometimes brings up the feeling that I'm resistant to do the inquiry, and then there's this sort of remarkably unremarkable recognition that I'm already doing it, I'm already tasting and operating from this awareness of the ground of who I am. And then much like Vinky said, and I really, really, I almost cried when I heard it, was that recognition that that everything is me. And I'm reluctant to try and share too much of that because it's so easy to fall into the words that come from all the scriptures and the books that I and many other people have read and devoured and attempts to try and find it through understanding it. But your work keeps pointing us to that, the taste of our own mouth, you know, the taste against which all is tasted, and that in order to taste it, it's like you have to infer through everything else. And one of the ways it seems to arise is that just to see everything else is me. And I had quite an opening while listening to your podcast over the summer and in reading a Zen koan that I think it's Dongshan who has said that don't seek from others, otherwise you'll be estranged from yourself. And that it is me, I am not it. And there's a big difference, and I know that that difference is tied to the work that you're doing and the way that you do it, the manner in which you do it, which I know you struggle with because you can't explain, but we all feel to the extent that we're feeling it at all, we know that it has to do with not thinking and flipping everything around and continually getting in touch with not that object of what we are, but the subject. And I can't thank you and all the work that you do and everyone that steps forward to do this kind of thing because it is me.
Yes, that's right. I couldn't say it better. I'm Katie from Kitchener. That's what I call you, Katie from Kitchener. I'm very happy to hear this from you. And is there anything I can do for you?
The biggest gift that you give continually is to pay witness to this depth and to speak from this depth. And I guess just, A, there's a privilege to being met here and to have this acknowledged. I see awakening, if you will, as a kind of a progressive stumble, and that it's never over, but the very expectation for it to become more than it is, I understand and remind myself, if you will, that that is an attempt to put it out as an object, and that I gently allow that to happen sometimes because I've feel that part of my gift may be in talking about this and sharing it, and I tend to blab on about it all the time to people that have no interest in spirituality, but because of necessity, have to have an interest in reality. And I just want to say as encouragement to anybody that you may get this in your head and then wonder if you've got it because you don't know how to move forward with it. And I swear, when you are at that stage, life will kick you. And it's in the challenges that you realize that you are not this life, but that only when you know deep down that nothing matters, can it matter. And then that's when life really starts, you know, because you're choosing the plot line and you're choosing your characters and you're just loving from that position. And that's a day-to-day commitment.
Well, it's certainly true that when you see that you are not at stake in this life, that's when the love affair with life really can begin. When you see that you're not on the line here, that every thought doesn't threaten you, that every desire doesn't say something about you, that every experience doesn't define you, when you lose the underlying belief, that this unseeable belief that you are something at stake here, then it certainly is true that for the first time and only the only way in which it's possible for you to see that all is one and that what you said. There's no need. It's my experience that over time, the personality itself, the apparatus, the structural device that is this mind-body, the history of it, the shape of it, the nature of it, and so forth, that over time, in the inquiry, the personality itself softens and sweetens. But that's really quite surprising to me. It doesn't seem that that should be the case, but it is. And it can only be the result of the destruction of the belief that you're at stake here, that you're on the line here, that your very existence is threatened here. So thank you, Katie. Is that all?
Thank you so much. I think so. I just thank you so much for your work and for doing this and for everyone listening. We're really in this together, you know. Thank you.
That's the real truth. We're in this together. Thank you so much. Okay.
Rupam, calling from Western Australia.
Hi, Rupam. I was about ready to say, okay, we're going to quit now, but then Carla said it was Rupam, so hi, how are you?
Thank you, John. It's wonderful to be able to be in connection like this again, but it's been absolutely perfect that I couldn't be. And just what you were speaking about today, to really be pushed to see it is here, the courage to recognize that only I can make this journey and no one else can. Release me from the suffering but myself. I'm so grateful, John.
Me too, Rupam. And it certainly is the case. There can be no greater authority as to what you are than you. In fact, there can be no authority as to what you are than you. The Buddha said long ago, don't believe anything you read. Don't believe anything you hear. Don't believe anything anybody tells you. Especially don't believe anything I tell you unless it's confirmed in your own experience and your own common sense and your own innate intelligence. You are the authority. You. So thank you, Rupan.
Thank you, John. And I just wanted to say one other thing, and that's that ever since I began this spiritual journey, the seeking of bliss has driven quite extreme behaviors. It doesn't make sense anymore. It's incredible. It arises, but it has no meaning.
Yes, that's true. We spiritual seekers could do with a little rehab of our own from bliss seeking and so forth, but we don't really need rehab. What we need is the light of truth, as you have seen for yourself, being a long-time bliss junkie. Thank you, Rupam. It's so wonderful to see you. Please give my love to Keith, and I will be in touch. Okay, well, that's it. I guess I don't have anything else to say. I never really have very much to say again, except look at yourself. It's not hard. And Duane, I think, pointed out the fact that, I think it was Duane, boy, I'm bad with this stuff, pointed out the fact that when you're in the midst of resistance and recoiling from the demands of self-inquiry, that you are actually doing self-inquiry. That reaction doesn't arise except in reaction to your movement toward looking at yourself. And if it takes you away from that, if it distracts you from that, that's okay, because the inclination to do so will come back. Here's the simple, plain fact of the matter. If you see yourself as directly, without mediation, without understanding, without anything at all, if you bring into your personal consciousness, by whatever means necessary, this taste of the spaciousness that you are, if you do that whenever it occurs to you to do so, everything else will be taken care of. Everything. Everything. So, I can't tell you how grateful I am and how moved I am at the response that that we've been receiving to this message that we bring, this possibility that we bring, that we offer, this possibility that really has the chance of seeing a human species. You know, this species just kind of popped into being. It evolved. It just came out of evolutionary processes and came adorned with this magnificent, unexpected, insane sense of separation, this totally incomprehensible sense of me and you, of me and those hills that I see out of my window here, this sense of an individual seeing things, tasting things, wanting things, not wanting things. This species evolved into being just like everything else, the consequence of forces, karmic actions, and so forth, over the whole span of time. And it appears with these magnificent and absolutely unexpected aspects to it. The aspect of self-consciousness, the aspect of feeling that there's me looking at things, the aspect of being able to have to turn energetic movement into to discrete, concrete experiences and to tell stories about it. This species, this human race, this wildness that is humanity. And we have always, from the beginning, we have yearned for and sought after and wanted the truth. We have known that there was more to things than meet the eye, but couldn't find it, couldn't put our finger on it. Couldn't get it. We've tried everything over the years. Everything. Every kind of political, economic, and religious, spiritual, and sexual and practice that we could possibly try over the years, to no avail. And now, for the first time, really, with the appearance of Ramana, who had his own limitations, you know, he isn't a god, he isn't like an angel that's come down from on high to save us, he is a human being, like you and I, who had this absolutely unexpected opening into reality. No reason for it to happen. So that in this time, with the appearance in the world of human beings of the insight that the only problem is a false belief about what I am, and the solution is really, really simple. It's here always, this light, this reality, always here. And it doesn't take understanding it. It doesn't take changing yourself, and it doesn't take fixing yourself. It doesn't take doing anything except looking at it, that the seeing does all the work in destroying belief about what I am. Now, finally, for the first time in the, 100,000 years of human evolution, since humans, maybe longer, since humans became humans, for the first time, there really is a possibility for everybody, not just for the saints and the gurus and the avatars and the saintly ones, but for everybody, everybody, without exception, to be finished with falseness, to be finished with the underlying sense that I am at stake in this life and that I need to do something about you, so that I am happy, that I need to do something about the thoughts that afflict me, so that I am happy. For the first time, this unquestioned condition. For the first time, it's possible to see through it and to dissolve it like the mist in the morning sun for all of humanity. And what then? That's my question. What then? All of humanity free. All of humanity untroubled by the experience of separation. All of humanity untroubled by the experience of the body and the mind. Untroubled by the insanity of thought. All of humanity untroubled by the sense of fearfulness and anxiety that comes from the conviction that I am at stake here. We are as we are, the radiance and the instruments of pure awareness, as we are, as all things are, in seeing itself directly. I yearn for the day when we are all, as we are already all in the same boat, we are already in the same, in this together. I yearn for the day when we are all in the same boat, free from fear and anxiety, free from aggression and hatred, free from all of the karmic consequence of the certainty that I am here alone and that I have to fight and kill and fix and hold in order to survive. There's no one anywhere. There is no human being anywhere who cannot do this. There is no human being anywhere who is any different from or separate from you and me. So, thank you so much. I'm just really blown away by all of you. We have some plans and ideas for the coming time, which Carla will talk to you about in a moment. We are always, Carla and I, looking at and searching for new methods to bring this teaching, this opportunity, this possibility to everybody. If you have any ideas about that, let us know. Be in touch. Write to me. I love you all. Be well. Good night.